Good morning and welcome to Studio 619. I'm Susan Sweeney Crum. Coming up in a few minutes, WFPL's Rick Hallett talks with Al Smith, who has been the host of Comment on Kentucky on KET for the last 33 years. His last show airs this Friday in a one-hour special. First, Louisville residents have been breathing polluted air for years. Now there's hope of improving air quality as several city programs take shape or move into their next phase. One targets the tiny particulates that come from burning fossil fuels called fine particulates. Another tackles toxic chemicals. WFPL's Kristen Espeland reports on the program's progress in this two-part series.
Perched atop buildings around Louisville, several metal tanks attached to white boxes are steadily sniffing the air for harmful chemicals. When those tanks' bellies are full of sampled air, they're brought back here to the air quality lab at the University of Louisville. Scientists then scan the air samples for traces of nearly 80 different toxic compounds. Russell Barnett heads the lab. He says each sample reveals dangerously high concentrations of toxics. One sample site is on Campground Road in southwest Louisville.
So this sample happened to be taken on the 22nd of October in West Louisville, and we can see then by looking at these concentration units here, what we're showing here is that we're getting some acetone, we're getting methyl chloride, methyl acetate, freon 113, carbon disulfide.
All chemicals suspected or known to be cancer-causing. They come from a rainbow of polluters, from the smokestacks of big power plants to the byproducts of manufacturing to diesel engines and dry cleaners. And they're just one kind of air pollution. In addition to toxics, there are greenhouse gases and tiny particles that come from burning fossil fuels. But when it comes to toxics, Air Quality Lab Chief Russell Barnett points out that big industry's share isn't as large as one might think.
And let's remember that a lot of these chemicals we're talking about, 1,3-butadiene being a perfect example of that, it's not just from industry. There's a lot of area sources, which means that they don't have a permit at all, but they're emitting something. It might be like a dry cleaners or a paint shop, and it's coming from mobile sources.
Mobile sources like cars and trucks. It's these smaller sources a city task force turns its attention to now. Art Williams heads the city's air pollution control district. He says a growing body of data and concerned citizens made the district sit up and take notice of toxics and their often ignored sources.
When we began to really understand that at the neighborhood scale, that you can have a very significant number of small sources come together in a way that creates a much larger footprint than any one of them does individually.
Researchers gathered years of data to show cancer-causing toxic chemicals were at dangerously high levels, especially in certain parts of Louisville. That led to the creation of the city's toxics reduction program called STAR. In its first 2 years, STAR focused on industrial sources of toxics, and Williams says it's beginning to work.
And we've had numerous companies that have changed their processes or added additional controls to reduce the toxics that they would have otherwise emitted.
For instance, one manufacturer responsible for much of the cancer-causing 1,3-butadiene in Louisville's air installed equipment to reduce those emissions by 80%. But as Williams says, industry is just one piece of the toxic puzzle. The next phase of the STAR program studied the others and came up with recommendations. For example, asking drivers to cut off diesel engines that would otherwise be idling, or requiring dry cleaners to update their machinery. Now it's up to the task force to present the recommendations to city legislators and ask for the business community's cooperation. Williams says the result may be some new regulations.
If we try and restrict the amount of idling in terms of the time, it would require regulation. If we further reduce the perchloroethylene from dry cleaners, that could require a regulation. So there are a few of the recommendations that could and would require some regulations, but the vast majority of these I like to think of more as partnerships out in the community.
In other words, what's not practical to legislate will be left up to educating and encouraging the small business community to cooperate, all part of a set of 35 recommendations from the STAR Task Force. Some businesses may not hesitate to volunteer, but those that don't voluntarily reduce emissions may face no consequences. The problem rests on the city's shoulders partly because some of these smaller sources require no kind of federal permit. What's more, Williams says the Environmental Protection Agency's toxics plan has sputtered. So the hope is to step in where federal and state regulations leave off. But the toughest crowd to take on may be yet another source of toxics from the cars of drivers like you and me. School's out at Norton Elementary School off Brownsboro Road, and cars are streaming into the parking lot. Parents wait and let the engines idle while teachers herd the first and second graders toward their minivans and hatchbacks. They may have no idea that all that idling is cooking up a toxic soup of chemicals in the air. To find out just how much of one particularly toxic chemical, a compound called benzene, is floating around, the city's air pollution control district has dispatched Tula McDermott. She sets up a portable air quality monitor inside the ring of cars right on the asphalt. It looks like a couple of suitcases with a 21st century vacuum hose and a tiny computer screen. On that, she checks the benzene readings.
They start at near zero and continue to go up as long as the cars are idling. During the summertime, the cars idled for up to an hour before the children were being picked up.
The monitor detects benzene in parts per million, and levels of this carcinogen can hit the double digits on a bad day. That's several times the amount you might breathe in just walking down a city street. And kids are more vulnerable to the effects of toxics. The data McDermott collects could help school officials convince parents to carpool or let their kids walk home. McDermott's boss, Art Williams, says diesel exhaust tops his list of concerns now, not only because of its toxic ingredients, but also because of its contribution to ground-level ozone and tiny particles in the air. We'll examine the city's new plan to deal with those. For WFPL, I'm Kristen Espeland. Susan Bowman spends a lot of time on rooftops. Here, atop a city government building in Louisville, she's replacing one of several filters collecting PM 2.5. That's the technical term for microscopic particles of carbon or sulfate and other materials floating around. It's burning fossil fuels that typically spews them into the city air, where it's just one ingredient in a stew of pollution. And Bowman's filters tell her just how much.
All right. This is a PM 2.5 unit. Here we are.
Every few days, PM 2.5 monitors on rooftops around the city suck in a steady stream of air. They catch the particulates on what looks like a little petri dish lined with a coffee filter. And every few days, Bowman climbs up to collect them and put in a new, fresh filter. The city will use the data to prove it's meeting the federal standard for PM 2.5, which currently it's not. Back downstairs in her lab, Bowman pulls out a tray of fresh filters.
Okay, here is the sample of the filters before they're actually set up to go out to the field. You can tell they're all pretty white. And then these right here are ones that I just brought in today. So, yeah.
They're completely gray, even though particulates are too small to see, which means they've collected quite a bit of the stuff. They'll be weighed on an extremely sensitive scale, and the results will be plugged into a database. Bowman pulls up the data from one sampling day, October 22nd.
So this is what we have.
On that day and on many others, PM 2.5 levels soared well above the federal limit. The limit is an annual average of 15 micrograms of particulate matter per cubic meter of air. And on average, Louisville's readings are 15.5. Maybe it seems such a tiny amount shouldn't matter, but scientists say no amount of particulates is safe. At Jewish Hospital in Louisville, lung specialist Judah Skolnick sees patients whose existing lung diseases make them more susceptible to the problems particulates can cause. He says breathing them in, whether it's a lower concentration over a lifetime or a higher concentration in a shorter period of time, first irritates the airways.
Which can cause cough, it can cause wheezing. As it gets further down into the air sacs, fluid can actually begin to accumulate in the lungs. You can get increased susceptibility to infection. You can get impaired lung function and gas exchange.
The lungs have to work harder to get oxygen to the body. And once inside the lungs, Skolnick says particulates can travel even further.
If it gets into the small blood vessels and into the circulation, it can actually cause inflammation of coronary arteries. And if it gets up into the arteries in the cerebral circulation, you can get strokes.
And with already high concentrations of particulate matter in the region, Skolnick says several other factors combine to bump up the health risk.
Weather is a factor. If you have high humidity, a high temperature, and you get what's called an inversion where the gases and particulates don't disperse, you're going to get a higher concentration of it. There's sort of a synergistic effect. If other pollutants are high, you're going to get more symptoms from it.
The city's Air Pollution Control District has created a task force to tackle the particulate problem and get the city back into compliance with federal law. The EPA says Louisville must meet the federal standard of 15 micrograms per cubic meter by 2010, and a plan to get there is due in April of next year. But several members of the task force, including citizens, industry and local officials, along with scientists, are saying the city can do even better.
We're not proposing a number that can be guaranteed to protect the safety of the public.
Task force member Dr. John Lewis.
We're proposing a number that seems a reasonable goal within a certain length of time. And we all agree that you can't just put a number and say that's safe.
Because Lewis says there's no such thing as a safe level for particulates, but the task force decided a goal in the range of 10 to 12 is doable within a decade. Lewis says the city is already on track to meet the federal standard of 15 micrograms per cubic meter, and it would probably surpass that standard within a decade anyway without taking extra steps. That's according to future air quality models. Technological improvements already in place, like cleaner burning diesel and rules already on the books for power plants, are already affecting particulate levels. But Lewis says the models miss another possible scenario.
Now, that doesn't entirely account for the fact that what if the population increases? What if new industry starts up? What if the way you generate energy changes.
So Lewis says the task force's final plan, ready by February 2008, is likely to stick with the 10 to 12 recommendation, and it will look for reductions in particulate emissions from several sources, including big industry, as well as cars and trucks and construction equipment. Some of those recommendations will likely include a call to city government to ban idling for diesel engines, retrofit the city's fleet of vehicles to take biodiesel, and better coordinate traffic signals so that cars and trucks don't idle too long at stoplights. But other recommendations may not be put into law. They might just offer certain kinds of incentives to reduce emissions. And the trickiest source to motivate might be drivers like you and me. Head of the city's Air Pollution Control District, Art Williams, says residents of the Louisville metro region are driving more miles every year, and that means more and more particulates and other pollutants in the air. His big concern is diesel.
When diesel's burned, it's a really complicated soup of chemicals that come out of that process. Most of the chemicals that we're concerned about are carcinogens. They can cause cancer. And the levels are pretty dramatic that we found when we modeled the really busy intersections in town.
And particulates are one of those cancer-causing elements. Williams also says the loss of the vehicle emissions testing program is putting pollution back into the air that wasn't there while the program was in force. While the city can make progress reducing particulate emissions from several sources, emissions from vehicles aren't likely to be one of them anytime soon. For WFPL, I'm Kristen Aspelund.
Al Smith has been the host of KET's longest-running public affairs program for 33 years. Over the decades, Comment on Kentucky has served as a sounding board for Kentucky political writers. Smith will be honored Friday in an hour-long Comment on Kentucky special, which will also be his final show. He spoke with WFPL's Rick Howlett.
Well, what made you decide to hang up your microphone, Al?
Well, Rick, the next time I'm 79 years old and think that 80 is going to be old, kick me in the butt, will you? That's what happened last year. I decided, well, I was 79, you know, 80 is going to be old, won't it be? Yes, right. So I gave them a year's notice, and the year's up. And I'm too much short of 81 right now. But I've now I'm kind of wondering, well, what was all this about? No, I'm sort of kidding. I decided that this was a good time to go on to another challenge. This fall marks 60 years that I've been in journalism full-time. I left college in 1947 to go down to New Orleans. I got a job as a copy boy on the Times-Picayune and worked up shortly after to an editing job and worked in New Orleans for 10 years and then came to Kentucky again 50 years ago. I guess it was in late 1957, December 57, that I hired on to edit a weekly paper in Russellville. So there's two anniversaries, the 60th anniversary of going to work for the newspaper in New Orleans and the 50th anniversary of going into journalism in Kentucky. And then I was 80 when I gave them my notice, I guess, and so that's why I sort of quit. I didn't want to have people wondering when I would leave, and I didn't want to have nobody ask me to go, but I didn't want to start messing up or getting into some difficulties that might be attributed to just being a little too old for the work.
Well, you're not the kind of person who's going to sit in a rocking chair from now on.
So I hope not. But, you know, all of us say that. It's funny how those things work out. You just learn, if you've been fortunate enough to get to a certain decade or so past the normal, well, the averages, you learn to just kind of take one day at a time. In fact, taking one day at a time has been kind of important for me because that's the way I finally stopped drinking 45 years ago after a bout with a bottle that nearly ended my journalism career once and for all, something to do about just do it one day at a time. And so that's sort of where I am now. Yeah, I've got a lot to do. I want to finish a book. I'm writing on journalism and politics, a memoir. And I've got a couple of programs, one for journalism, rural journalism, at the University of Kentucky that I've been raising money for and supporting it. My friend Al Cross runs. You remember Cross at the Courier Journal
of
Political
of course.
Science, a political reporter there. Well, he's over at UK as a professor and working with rural newspapers and radio stations across the state, and I work with him. And then I've got another program I'm working with an African-American church in Lexington, trying to do something with kids who are caught up in the justice system, mostly for selling drugs. And we're trying to – that's a companion piece. I got an inner-city program and a rural program to keep me occupied, plus some writing.
Well, you have it covered then. Well, how did you become the host of Comment on Kentucky? How did that come about?
In 1974, Lynn Press's version, Lynn was the founding director of KT. He told a magazine article of a magazine writer recently that he went to the Kentucky Press Association to look for a journalist who could do a program on public affairs. And he found me when I was, I guess, president or vice president of KPA, and he decided he didn't need to look any further. The way I remember it, I was serving on a board of advisors at KET, and Lynn brought up the possibility of doing a public affairs program, and some members on this advisory committee thought it was a terrible idea because no one would trust a program about state politics that was being broadcast by a state agency, that is Kentucky Educational Television. Well, I argued that it could be done, but I really didn't have any idea he had me in mind. Whatever it was, he came to me in the late summer of 1974 with the idea that I do it. And so I named it Comment on Kentucky. We put it on the air in either October or November of 1974. And the first guest was U.S. federal judge, district judge, Max Swinford of Cynthiana, a wonderful man, a jurist who was respected all over the state. And he'd written a book called Kentucky Lawyer, Anecdotes About Lawyers and By Lawyers, Stories Lawyers Tell, and had a strong rural flavor to it. So I interviewed him about that book, and I also interviewed him about the Watergate trials that had just concluded. And that was our program. I'd not been in a television station, neither Judge Swinford. We sat there in two rocking chairs and told each other stories, and that was the first Comment on Kentucky show.
And you've had mostly journalists on since then?
Yeah, it's a writer's show, a journalist show. When I say writers, I also mean really radio and television people also, and book writers and professors, college academics, most of whom have usually written something. And I've had occasional filmmakers. We've not since 1975 have we had any elected officials. We talk about elections a lot. We talk about about politicians and people running for office, but we don't have elected officials as guests. Some of those appear on KET's Kentucky Tonight program on Mondays with Bill Goodman, which makes sort of a good bookend for the weekend on KET. You have me on Friday night, or did have me, with opinionated journalists. Well, we like to say giving insight perspective. Some are opinionated, and including the host, I guess. But I will say yes. But then on Monday nights, they have a strict, very calibrated, balanced program where they may have a Republican or a political person from one party talking about an issue. Well, they'll put somebody from the other side on the same panel, and we don't do that. I don't calibrate the listeners. What I do, guests, what I do try to do, if one of my guests goes too far, in my opinion, into biting away at somebody or attacking somebody, I try to bring it back to the middle, usually with a simple question, like, say they're criticizing, say Steve Beshear, they're criticizing him. That's fine, we do that. But then my answer would be, finally, I might say, well, what do you think Beshear would say if he were on the program? Or criticize Governor Fletcher. Well, if the governor were here to defend himself, what do you think he'd say? And that generally puts us back on the mid-course.
We're talking with Al Smith from Comment on Kentucky. Any special plans for your final show?
Yeah, we got a big show set up. There are 300 people coming for a reception at 6, a dinner at 7, and a one-hour show statewide at 8 o'clock Eastern Time on Friday, November 16th. There'll be two panels. The first panel, I call it Panel A, of journalists who are currently on the program a lot. They'll be on for about 20 minutes. And then the second panel will be four journalists who were on the show 25, 30 years ago. And the way I like to tell it is the first panel is journalists who think they know what's going on, and the second panel will be journalists who used to think they knew what was going on. And in between, a short film about Russellville, Kentucky, where I was living as editor and publisher of the paper when I started the Comment show. We call it Russellville, the Roots of Comment, and we're back there walking around the streets and talking to people who were friends of mine 30 years ago.
You're based in Lexington now, aren't you?
Yeah, I live in Lexington. I came here from London, Kentucky, where I lived for 6 years after I bought the Weekly in London in 1981. That time it was the largest weekly in the mountains, and I moved to London from Washington. I sound like a gypsy. I'd been in Washington for 3 years or 2 years as federal co-chairman of the Appalachian Regional Commission.
I see. Any word yet on who's going to take your place?
Good question. No. I've heard two versions. One is they might – well, just one version. One version is they may rotate it. Rotate the moderating job, the moderator's job, for a little while, but I'm not sure. I think it will be somebody outside the network. I believe they will continue the tradition with me of having someone who does not work for state government as host. I've been a vendor, a contractor. They give me a contract every year, and I do the show for a year, and then I sign a new contract. The idea, of course, being to keep some distance between the state and what the panelists say on the program and what the producer chooses to do.
Well, we'll be watching. And Al, thanks for joining us today, and good luck to you.
Great. Thank you. Enjoyed being with you.
More information about Al Smith, Comment on Kentucky, and KET is available at our website, WFPL.org. When we come back, WFPL's Heidi Caravan has the details of National Children's Book Week and how to detect and treat learning disabilities. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Susan Sweeney Crum. Coming up a little later in the show, Robin Fisher speaks with Don McCaig, the author of Rhett Butler's People. It's the second authorized sequel to Gone with the Wind. First, it's National Children's Book Week, an annual celebration of reading for pleasure. But what if reading isn't pleasurable at all? What if it's a struggle you've had to deal with your entire life? The director of the Langsford Learning Centers, Stephen McCrocklin, was an adult before he got the necessary tools to read. Now he's helping others to do the same. He shared his experiences with WFPL's Heidi Caravan.
Tell us a little bit about the Langsford Center and your experiences and how the Langsford Center came to be.
Well, the Langsford Learning Center was born out of the challenges that I had as a child learning to read. I graduated from eighth grade as a person who enjoyed school but yet was a non-reader. And in high school, I was able to build enough sight words to read at a functional level, and this held me through college graduation. But I realized that in order for me to go to any further steps, that I really had to both be able to read words that I'd not seen before, so that I couldn't really just rely on my sight word memory.
What are sight words, Stephen?
Sight words are words that are words that we see that are high frequency that we've memorized the shape of, so that at a glance we know what it is. At the time, though, even though I had memorized these words, I didn't have the tools to explain how all the letters worked in that word, and so I couldn't apply my knowledge of sight words to sounding out a word I'd never seen before. And so that really weakened my ability to read new or novel information. It was after college that I found some solutions that completely changed my ability to read and comprehend. And in that process, it became clear to me that what my calling or what I really needed to do was to make these kinds of opportunities available in both the Louisville area and to kids who were also struggling.
You'd mentioned after college, so you were able to get through high school and college effectively being illiterate?
Not being able to sound out new words, and consequently slow and labored. Any word I didn't know, I had to skip and try to guess through context. And so the result of that was that reading was a very laborious, draining, time-consuming process. So I wasn't able to have the extracurricular opportunities that other kids had because I was really in the library studying.
How would you get through, for example, a novel? If somebody said, okay, we have to do a selection of novels for literature class.
I never missed a class in college or high school, for that matter. I attended every class, even if I was sick, because I needed to be present and hear the classroom discussion and gather from the teacher both what they thought was important and their interpretation of the book. I participated in study groups so that when I did read the book, I had a lot of the right ideas going into the chapter, what it was about. So I relied on context a lot. I relied on context of not just the words in the sentence, but the framework that was set up in class.
So you were working probably four or five times harder than everybody else in trying to read the information. What happened then after college when you realized there's something going on here?
What I was interested in when I graduated from college was medical school. I was always intrigued with how things worked. It was very interesting to me to understand anything from the most basic machines to complicated machines. Where I realized the last couple of years in college was the most sophisticated machine and the most advanced technology we had really was the human body. And so that drew me to medical school, thinking that if I both understood in real depth how it worked, perhaps I could help repair it when it was either broken or becoming ill. And so that drew me to medicine. And the stumbling block there initially for me was getting a competitive score in one particular set of the medical college admission test. The one particular set or subset was a reading comprehension test, and it required me to read lengthy passages very quickly and to answer fairly sophisticated questions that required me to read between the lines. And I couldn't get through it in a time that allowed me to have a competitive score there. The areas that I could practice for and could prepare for, like biology, chemistry, and physics, I performed very, very well in. And it became clear to me that I would not have an opportunity in medical school if I weren't to change that score. So I became very vested and very motivated in finding solutions for my reading difficulties, and that encompassed basically a nationwide search for the best scientifically based program with a proven track record that could help me change the way I learned to read and learn to learn. And I found that resource on the West Coast, and it was a very small reading clinic. I took a leave of absence from what I was doing and moved out there for what I thought would be about 10 weeks of work. Not only did that 10 weeks evolve into something longer than that, I was offered a position, completed the work there at that reading clinic, and they did a post-evaluation, and the gains and changes that I made were so strong that they offered me a position working with other people, same challenges that I had. My background in science has helped because we were seeing at that clinic doctors as well as nurses who were struggling to pass medical boards. I worked for them for just under 3 years and returned to Louisville after that to try to do some work here.
You mentioned off-air that your parents were both in the medical field. Was it frustrating to them as well?
It was. My father was a surgeon and my mother was a registered nurse. All the right things had been offered to me when I was young. I had been read to. Both my parents clearly were very literate. My mother, before she was a nurse, also completed her MBA. Education was highly valued. We had hundreds and hundreds of books in our home, and yet nothing that we did. I attended a school that was a private school, and everyone, after a period of time, just sort of shrugged their shoulders and said, "We don't know what more to do." It was challenging, I know, for my parents, and frustrating at times that I wasn't able to make better progress. And it was challenging for my teachers. And yet, what I was most, you know, sort of blessed with is at the end of the day, the frustrations would all be set aside, and they knew I was working as hard as I could and was truly doing the best I could. So I never felt uncared for or unappreciated or unrecognized for my efforts, just more of this sort of scientific puzzle of what is it that's not working in my brain to learn to read that does for so many people.
You must see several students at the Langsford Learning Center and think to yourself, that was me.
Yes. From the bottom up, from the very first day that the other director, my wife and I, who co-founded the Langsford Center, from the very first day started out with a vision of starting from the very bottom up, every item that was brought into this office was intentional to make it the very best place and the most welcoming place for someone who has a challenge in reading. Sometimes we see students, we see adults who are truly non-readers who weren't able to build up a sight word base and are truly illiterate. And we see first graders who are not emerging on the trajectory that we would expect. And so we see people across a whole continuum. We see, interestingly enough now, we do see medical students who are in medical school and feel like they need a boost to keep up with the work. So we see people across the whole spectrum because the challenges that people have in reading don't go away with age. And that's probably one of the biggest and most important understandings we've had in the last decade in reading, is that for so long we believed that all kids will learn to read if we just put books in their hand and put them in a good environment. And we know very clearly that they're not. We understand that reading difficulties run through families, so there's a hereditary component. We understand the circuitry in the brain, neurobiologically speaking, that doesn't come together in many people who have reading difficulties. A lot can be done, but it does require early recognition. And that's probably one of the most important pieces that a listener could leave with, is that if there are difficulties in a child's reading development, it doesn't tend to go away with age.
It does run in families. Your own daughter went through the program a couple of years back.
I learned later that my father had some difficulties, and there were also some bumps with another family member, an uncle, who also had a very successful career. And I noticed that what these men did to compensate was they were just very, very dedicated, and they prepared very carefully and stayed very current with things. But it does. My daughter, who is a fifth grader, has taken part in the courses and opportunities that we offer, and I'm just so fortunate to be able to have with her identified challenges when she was young and to be able to get the kind of brain changes and the kind of brain training and rewiring that allows her now to be a self-correcting, independent, automatic reader, and fortunately not have to go through the struggles that I went through as a student, as a child.
What would a parent notice? Just general difficulty in comprehension? What would a parent notice to think, my child isn't reading the way they should?
Well, if we break reading down into sort of its two main components, one would be reading the printed word, and the other would be understanding what they all mean when they're put together. One of the biggest red flags for someone who's not on the trajectory for being able to read words and to sound out words is to watch how they approach words that they don't know when they're reading in context. A skilled reader will come to a word and they will stop and sound it out. They might read through each letter sound and then blend them all together to say the new word. In a good reading trajectory, they would do that and maybe a number of times with that word, after which it becomes automatic, and then that word is then absorbed into their system to become sort of a sight word or an automatic word. A poor reader, however, will often come to that word and not know what to do with it, so their eyes will skip ahead to the words, the words ahead of it, the words behind it. They might scan around the page and then make a guess. And that's a compensative mechanism. That's what someone does when they can't figure out the word because they haven't broken the code. That's really the biggest thing to look for, is when someone's guessing words rather than sounding them out. In comprehension, and this is an area that's particularly concerning to me, is that there are students, there are frankly many people, who can read all the words exactly correctly. They can sound out any word you put in front of them. And yet, at the end of a paragraph, you ask that student, what did that mean? Tell me in your own words what that paragraph was about. And they look up and they shrug their shoulders and they say, I don't know. I'm not sure. And it can look like that person isn't trying, that they're just, you know, disinterested. It can look like they have an attention problem. But it can also be that truly they don't comprehend it.
Stephen McCracklin, director of Langsford, thanks so much for joining us today. I really appreciate your time.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That was Stephen McCracklin, director of the Langsford Learning Centers. He spoke with WFPL's Heidi Caravan. When we come back, WFPL's Robin Fisher talks with author Don McCaig. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Susan Sweeney Crum. In the novel Gone with the Wind, when Rhett Butler said, "Frankly, Scarlett, I don't give a damn," and walked out the door, did you ever wonder where he went? Author Donald McCaig not only wondered what became of Rhett, he also wondered where Rhett had come from in the first place, and just who were Rhett Butler's people. McCaig was so curious, he eventually found himself writing the second authorized sequel to Gone with the Wind. WFPL's Robin Fisher spoke with McCaig about his new novel, the aptly titled Rhett Butler's People.
How do you get to the point where you are the one writing the authorized novel? Do you call them and say, hey, I'd like to do this?
I think a lot of people did. I didn't. It was kind of a fluke. What happened was they had been looking for a writer for 6 years that actually commissioned one book, and they just hated it. They being the executors, the Margaret Mitchell Estate. And I had written a book called Jacob's Ladder, which was a big, thick Civil War novel. And when Jacob's Ladder came out in paperback, the blurb on the cover was from People magazine, and the blurb was, think Cold Mountain, think Gone with the Wind. And an editor from St. Martin's, the publishers, spotted that, opened it up, liked it, sent it to the executors. They liked it, and so they called me, said, would you be interested in doing this? And my initial feeling was probably not. I've never worked with another writer's work before. I'm not real fond of sequels, and I'd never read Gone with the Wind. But I sat down and I read Gone with the Wind, and I found out something that interested me. And it was that you have a love story where one of the characters, Scarlett O'Hara, is developed probably better than any other character in American literature. She's certainly the best woman character. She's vain, she's loyal, she's flirtatious, she's courageous, she's shrewd, she's... all the contradictions that make an actual human being, she's got in her. And she's really a fascinating character, but against her, her lover and husband, Rhett Butler, is probably more an attitude than he is a real character. I mean, yes, he's got a sardonic smile, and yes, he always gets the last word, but you know practically nothing about him. He vanishes from Gone with the Wind for months at a time, going Lord knows where for what purpose. He's wealthy, a wealthy speculator slash businessman, but it isn't very clear how he makes his money. I mean, what does he do? Go in the woods and some genie hands him a pot of money from time to time? And most astonishing for a book written by a Southern writer and a Southern woman writer is we know nothing about his family. And, of course, that's the first question we Southerners ask about each other.
We do that here in Kentucky.
Oh, yeah. Well, Kentucky counts as South. Anyway, so I wondered, I didn't want to do a conventional sequel, but I wondered if I could make a sort of companion book and cover some of the same scenes and time period as the original and sort of fit Rhett Butler's view, what became Rhett Butler's people, into the slots view that Margaret Mitchell had left. And I thought that would be an interesting book. And, you know, I mean, if you're going to do one of these things, you're going to spend years of your life doing it, then you've really got to be interested in it. You can't just say, well, I'm going to do this because I'm going to, you know, get paid for it. You have to be fascinated by the possibilities. And this seemed to me to be complicated and interesting, and nobody had ever done anything quite like this before. So I went down to Atlanta and met the publishers and the executors. The executors at the time were two elderly Southern gentlemen of the old school. Their word was and is their bond. They're absolutely straightforward people. And I said, well, this is what I'd like to do, and if that suits you, then I'll do it. And if it doesn't suit you, if you want something else, then I'm sure you can find another writer to do it. And they thought it was a good idea. I mean, somewhat to my surprise, I hadn't had any time invested in it by that time. And so they said, yeah, go ahead. So I did, and 6 years later, Rhett Butler's People hits the bookstores.
Well, you know, as I read it, I kept wondering, you know, what are the challenges in writing a sequel to a famous novel? And how do you make sure that your work both complements the original but can also stand on its own?
Well, compliments of the original was in some ways easier. Although I must admit that my mother warned me not to do things like this. She said, Donald, you're not smart enough to do something like that. But anyway, my wife Ann went through Gone with the Wind and did a chapter by chapter outline of the entire book. Her outline ended up being about 120 pages. And in it, she said exactly what the action was in the chapter, and at the end of it, which characters were in it and which characters were mentioned in the chapter. So if, for instance, I was writing my book, I could just go to her synopsis, and it would tell me, for instance, well, did this character survive the war? Was he wounded? If you're going to use him, you know, it has to mesh with the original. So that part of it was mostly okay. And as I say, Margaret Mitchell left these great big spaces in there. The difficulty was when I had to write the same scenes that she wrote. And in several of her, you know, famous scenes, the barbecue scene and the escape from burning Atlanta scene, I did too. And working her dialogue, which it had to be her dialogue, with my way of looking at the world, was pretty tough.
Well, you know, I found it to be pretty seamless because when I was reading, you know, of course, I remember the scene in the library at the barbecue.
Yeah.
But there were times when I would read and I would think, did I know this?
Yeah, it's going to have a certain feeling of deja vu for particularly people who really know Gone with the Wind, and there are people who read Gone with the Wind every year.
Right.
And I suspect for them, you know, I hope for them this will enrich their pleasure in the original, but it also had to be a story that somebody could pick up and read, a reader who had never read Gone with the Wind and never would. And that was, I mean, it had to be both of those things. It had to mesh seamlessly with Gone with the Wind. It had to be historically accurate, and it had to be a story in its own right.
Well, you know, it's interesting because I had that in mind as I was reading it, because I have a bad habit, or had a bad habit of reading what I would call family saga novels out of order.
Oh.
And I think that this is one that you could pick this up and want to know more about Scarlet, as you could pick up Gone with the Wind and want to know more about Rhett.
Yeah, I think so. I think, as a matter of fact, I'm not the only one who thinks this. Clearly, whoever has the paperback rights for Gone with the Wind thinks so too, because all of a sudden it appeared on the stands, you know, in the bookstores in large quantities in the center aisle, just as Jacob's Ladder was being released. So, I mean, the publishers think so, too. And I do. I mean, if you are interested in that great love story in the middle of America's bloodiest war, then, sure, why not? Read the one and then take a look at the other one. I'm not comparing. I mean, Gone with the Wind is more more than a novel. It's a phenomenon. And I don't write phenomenons, I write novels. But I think it's a pretty good one, and I think that readers are going to enjoy it.
Well, you know, let's talk for a second about the war, because I found that your descriptions of the war were very graphic and very lifelike, but not gratuitously graphic, for both the soldiers and then the people that they left behind, you know, especially on the Confederate side. And do you feel like the modern reader expects a more realistic picture of the war?
Oh, sure. I ran into this when I did Jacob's Ladder. What I'm concerned about when I'm telling one of these stories is not my obligation as a writer, as a novelist, is to tell the truth. That's my first obligation. So when I describe the battle at Franklin, for instance, the aftermath, I don't describe the actual battle. It's the morning after, when the wives and sweethearts and family members of the soldiers who'd fought there came to find their loved ones. And the description is absolutely accurate. And so, you know, the first thing I've got to be is accurate. When a couple of readers reading Jacob's Ladder said, but it was so bloody. And I was kind of shocked by that, and to which I could only kind of say in a stupefied fashion, but it really was.
War is bloody.
Yeah.
Let me ask you, do you think that there is one particular character in either your novel or in the original that cries out for their own book?
Yeah.
Are you going to share that with us?
No, not just yet. I'm wondering if I might want to write it, so I'll keep that one under my hat for a little bit.
Well, I'll look forward to it. Thank you very much for your time.
Okay, thank you, Robin.
That was WFPL's Robin Fisher talking with Donald McCaig about his new novel, Rhett Butler's People, the latest Gone with the Wind sequel authorized by the Margaret Mitchell Estate. McCaig will be signing copies of the book tomorrow evening at 7 at Borders Books and Music in the Shelbyville Road Plaza. For more information, go to our website at WFPL.org and click on Studio 619. More information about today's show is available online at WFPL.org. You can email us from there or listen to previous broadcasts in our audio archive. You can also write to us at Studio 619, 619 South 4th Street, Louisville, Kentucky, 40202. Or you can reach us by phone at 814-6500. Studio 619 is produced by the Public Radio Partnership. Everything you hear on Studio 619 is compiled by the staff at PRP, including WFPL, WFPK, and WUOL. We also air submissions from Kentucky Public Radio, a collaboration of all the public radio stations in the Commonwealth. Alice Thompson provides website direction. I'm Susan Sweeney-Crum. Join us next time for another edition of Studio 619 on WFPL.